This is the first interview with Miriam Allen DeFord on March 6, 1973. Interviewer Sherna Gluck, Feminist History Research Project. The interview took place in Miriam Allen DeFord's hotel suite at the Ambassador Hotel. The hotel is a rather dilapidated one, which at one time, she claims, was a good second-class hotel, and now is quite run down. Her own rooms, however, are not in such sad condition. She apparently furnishes the rug, furniture, and makes all the repairs at her own expense. Her suite consists of a small room which she uses as her study. It is cluttered with books, photographs, and is obviously quite lived in a place of a woman who is busy at work. Ms. DeFord is a rather slight woman with very thick glasses and apparently has some difficulty with cataracts as well as a hearing problem. Despite these physical disabilities and her 84 years, she is a very vigorous, lively, and intellectually curious woman. She is still busy at work at her profession of writing, and at the end of the interview showed me a recent honorable mention for some poetry that she had written. She was most cooperative and interested in providing whatever information we would find helpful. She is a rather fast talker and very often manifests a rather nervous laugh. It is more evident than it appears on the tape.
Well, let's begin with your background.
Well, as I suppose you know, I was born in Philadelphia. Never graduated from the girls' high school there. I never left Philadelphia until I went to college. My parents are both doctors. In a very poor, heavy industrial part of Philadelphia, northeast Philadelphia, they started out together. My father graduated from medical college a year before my mother, and they started in the shipyards and textile factories and that kind of thing. I don't think there were any people who could read and write in the neighborhood except the few doctors and their families.
It was primarily
I went to kindergarten in that section, but by the time I was ready to go to primary school, they sent me down to live with my grandmother in a more respectable part of the city.
Now, had your mother pursued her medical profession after she was married?
Yes, she had to stop in her 60s because she became deaf. But until then, she practiced right along.
Now, was she in medical school when they met, or did she go to medical school?
No, she went to women's medical in Houston, Jefferson. No, they met when my father's parents were both born in France, and though he was born in Philadelphia, it was in a section of the city that then was entirely French. He and his brother didn't speak English until he went to school. So he worked his way through high school and college and medical college. And one of the things he did was teach French, and that's how my mother met him. She went to his French class.
I see. Now, what was
my mother was 8 years older than my father.
When she first met him? Your mother was 8 years old then?
8 years older than my father, yeah. But actually, she always seemed younger, though she was prematurely gray. I never saw her without gray hair.
What kind of family background did she have that she went to medical
school? Well,
she
came from a family that had been in Philadelphia for about seven generations, I guess. And they were born and brought up in a part of the city that now is slums, but then it was mostly Quaker. All her early friends were Quakers.
Was she a Quaker?
No. No, I was brought up in I suppose you'd call it kind of Unitarian atmosphere, but we didn't do anything.
Now, was your mother's mother a feminist? How did your mother...
No, my mother's mother was proud of the fact that she had never in her life had crossed the street alone. When she was a child, her father took her, and her brothers, then her husband, then her sons. And when my brother was too young to take her across the street, she had to have her daughters take her.
Well, Well, how did your mother happen to go to medical school then?
Well, I suppose she'd had sort of vague interests and yearnings about it for a long time, and then after she met my father, and after they became engaged, they were engaged for 4 years. He persuaded her that it was possible, and I don't think my mother's family were at all pleased, but they had to reconcile themselves to it, and so she went. When my father was in his second year, she started. So she was a year behind him.
Because that was rather unusual for women.
Well, she graduated in 1887, and he graduated in 1886.
Now, he must have been a feminist then, given
his... Well, to a certain extent, I suppose. Remember, he refused to march in a parade once. He thought it would be too embarrassing to be one of the few men. But he certainly did put nothing in our way. I mean, and he was for women's suffrage. If it had been a question of voting, he would have voted for it. But he had no particular connection with it otherwise. But I don't know. Ever since I can remember, my mother was for votes for women, which was the thing then. When I was 14, she sent me down to suffrage headquarters to stuff envelopes.
Now, was she herself actively involved?
Not very. After all, my mother, who was a very small, slight woman, and practiced medicine and ran a house and even mended clothes. She was a terrible cook. Fortunately, she never cooked except when we were out of cooks. But she did have all that she could possibly handle without being very active. And I don't think she'd been physically able to march in parades or that kind of thing.
Now, did she took care of the household herself as well as working?
Oh, yes. I can remember back. As far back as I can remember, we did manage somehow to have what was then called a girl cook and house worker. And when we were small, we had nurses who were usually coal miners' daughters, Welsh coal miners' daughters from the coal mines in Pennsylvania. In fact, that's how the first thing I can remember, the first time that I remember thinking about, well, I didn't even know the word feminism then, but we had a Welsh nurse and an Irish cook, and the cook got married in the only wedding I've ever seen. I mean, I've been witness to lots of marriages. This was a Roman Catholic wedding. And the nurse took us to it. I think I was about 6 or 7, and my sister was 2 years younger. And then we went, the happy couple adjourned to the little row house in the back street that was going to be their home. Jenny kept us, who was, I don't know, it was Winnie. Winnie kept us standing at the door, not going in. Of course, you can imagine what it was. They were all grown people. We were the only children around. And I know now that everybody had plenty to drink at the reception, but of course I had no idea of it then. The bride was all in white satin. And I don't know, just some kind of argument came up. Somebody, the bridegroom had to express his machismo somehow. And one of his friends said, don't let her answer you back, start your marriage right. So he promptly knocked her flat on the floor. And Gwynnie hurried us away, and I went just boiling with indignation. And I remember saying he knocked her down because she wasn't as strong as he was. And if I ever get strong enough, I'll get up and fight back.
And how old were you then?
Well, I think I was about 6 or 7. I don't remember which. And from that time on, I was very much against most men and very much for most women.
So your attitude applied generally to men. It wasn't that you thought this was a specific
man. I thought he knocked her down because she was a woman.
Mm-hmm. And you thought that this was how men behaved towards
me. And I was terribly indignant. Of course, I was used to a household where my mother practically ran everything. My father did as he was told. I mean, domestically. So that was the first time I'd ever seen male, old-fashioned male dominance, and it made me very, very angry.
And did you generalize it towards all men?
Yes, I did. I remember telling my mother about it and saying, he knocked her down because she was a woman. And my mother didn't like to tell a child at that age that probably everybody was drunk. So she just said, well, that's the way people of that kind of age.
Now, what kind of feminist was your mother?
Well, as I say, she was, remember, this is all back in the 1890s, and as far as anybody was, she was all in favor of what we would now call women's lib. Of course, as a doctor, she got the same pay that a man would get, so we never had that question in the house of how a woman was doing the same work and getting less for it. And of course I'm lucky because I'm in one of the few professions where they don't ask you your sex or your age or your ancestry, it's just whether you produce.
Now, it was rather unusual in those days for a woman to both work and have a career.
It was unusual for a woman to have a professional career, yes. And of course that was before women were in offices. Stenographers were all men. But in the working class, of course, our washwoman was married, and sometimes when a cook got married, she came back. Mm-hmm. I can remember once that we had one of those backyard privies that the maid was supposed to use, and one of our girls who had come back after marriage somehow managed to lose her wedding ring down it. And she had hysterics because she said her husband would beat her when she got home. And so we had to call in the professionals at night. I could see her still with the lanterns and dig down and find her wedding ring to get her home again. And I remember the little old washwoman, I've forgotten her name, a German name, tiny little woman with her face covered with smallpox scars. It was very common in those days. And when she came Monday, she usually was bruised all over. Her husband got drunk every weekend and beat her up. And she took it philosophical because she expected that's what married life was like.
So you were aware of that?
All those things, you know, as I found out about them, made me feel more and more the way I started to feel.
Now, was that before the incident?
That was afterwards. That was when I was, I suppose, 9 or 10, something like that. I just stayed down a year with my grandmother, and then we moved to another part of the city, and I was brought home and sent to school near where I lived.
Now, in your childhood, though, your mother worked the entire time. She just took off time right around the birth of the children?
How do you mean?
While you were, how many children were there in the family?
Well, three, and I was the oldest. I had a sister 2 years younger and a brother 5 years younger.
Well, when the other children were born, did she continue to work and just take off a few months? Or did
well,
she
of course,
take
when,
off?
When my sister was born, I was only 22 months old, so I don't remember much about it. But when my brother was born, I was five. They thought then that I was too old to leave around the house. I wasn't supposed to know about such things, so I was sent to my grandmother's again. But I never saw my mother until after my brother was born. But as I remember, as soon as the baby, she never nursed any of us. She never could. And as soon as the baby was old enough to be left for, well, by that time, I think she did very little home visiting. Her patients came to her, and so it was easy enough to handle
a
baby. And at the same time, in our house that we moved to in the northwestern part of the city, what was other people's parlor downstairs was the office and waiting room.
Oh, I see. Now, did your mother
My father, in later years, had an office downtown, but my mother never did. She always had her patients at the house. And both their signs were brass signs were outside the house.
So they practiced together, then?
Not together, because my mother, I think, did mostly gynecology. And my father, at first, was a general practitioner, but became a genital urinary specialist. So that would be something my mother wouldn't be likely to do.
Now, And she must have been among the very early women gynecologists.
No, people always say that. She was the second generation. Her professors in medical college were the first generation.
They would be the Elizabeth Blackwell generation.
Women's Medical College was established when my mother was only 2 years old. But she told us a lot of stories about her years in medical school that also added to my family. For instance, there were some courses that they had to go to one of the men's medical colleges. I forget which one, whether it was Jefferson or Medical Chirurgical or maybe University of Pennsylvania. I don't remember. But anyway, you know how when they demonstrate and have an operation, they have all the students up. The girls had to sit at the very back. And one day, one impatient girl got up and walked right over people's heads down to the front and sat there. And they made things so unpleasant for her that she never tried it again. My mother said they used to yell after them in the street. I don't know what they yelled, but when they left the college.
The male students or the population generally?
The men resented very much having women study medicine with them.
Then when you were growing up, did you think that you would go into a professional career? Did you?
Well, it was taken for granted that I was going to study medicine and inherit both my parents' practices. So, no, as you know, to the younger generation, the one thing I would never do would be to study medicine. And besides, from the time I was 12, I knew I was going to be a writer, and I'd started even being published, so there was no question of that. Doing anything else.
But so from a very early age, you knew you would go into a profession, and then quite young.
Oh, yes, it was second to granted that we all would earn our living. My sister became a teacher and ended up as a supervisor of industrial arts in the Philadelphia schools.
Now, was it assumed that you would be a professional as well as be married, or it didn't matter?
Oh, no. I don't think the question ever came up. As far as that goes, my sister never did marry, and I think my family were a bit surprised when I was married twice. But I never remember any discussion on that point at all.
Now, when you...
It was taken for granted that whatever I did, I'd keep on doing.
If you were married or not.
Well, I suppose so, but nobody ever said anything. Uh-huh. Remember, this was still the Victorian age. But my mother was a doctor, but she never mentioned any question about sex. Nobody ever told me anything. I found out by reading my parents' medical books. When I was 8 years old, I had read so many of them, especially my mother's gynecological works, that I gave my sister a long, detailed account of just how one handles pregnancy and childbirth. I think I was 8 then. She said, well, what I don't understand is how the baby gets there. And I said, well, that's part I haven't found out yet, but it isn't important. But I can remember very well when I was a little older, sitting in the waiting room in my parents' office when there was nobody else there, and reading Croft Ebbing. And I'd hear a footstep. I'd get up and consult the dictionary quickly. After my father died, my sister sent me the Croft Ebbing, and I looked it over, and I never saw such a boring, dull book in my life. I still have it somewhere.
Were your parents part of any kind of radical tradition themselves?
No, they had, as far as politics goes, we were Democrats in our family and in a Republican city, in a very corrupt Republican city, where kids would yell Democrat at you down the street. And we took the Record, which was the Democratic paper. Of course, every respectable person in Philadelphia then took the Public Ledger, but we also took the Record. And we were the only Democrats I know. And my father considered himself something of a liberal. I think he once voted for Debs. And, of course, my mother couldn't vote. But I do remember, and I can't remember how young I was, but I was quite young. When Cleveland was elected the second time, and I remember my mother saying, I thought I'd die without seeing a Democratic president again. I'm so happy.
So her feminism didn't come out of a radical past, then.
Oh, no. No, we never, no, my, My mother never said anything. My father was horrified when I became a real radical. He wrote me long, long letters about how superior his mind was and how he'd been all through this, and it was just youthful exuberance, and I'd get over it.
Now, besides the incident where your mother sent you down to the suffrage headquarters, were you associated when you were quite young with the suffragists at all?
No, I can't remember it. Of course, when I was 14 and went down to headquarters, from that time on, I got to know all the people down there. The woman who was then a young woman who was in charge of headquarters was a very nice woman named Caroline Katzenstein. I remember her, or Katzenberg, I forget which. And I remember vaguely some of the other people there, an English woman or a French woman who lived in England for years and then was in America, and a few others. But by the time I was 18, I was really working with them. I mean, I don't think I did any writing yet for them, but I did. By that time, I was on, between high school and college, I was on the Philadelphia North American, and I was doing, well, I suppose, what we call public relations work. And then when we had the parades in New York, would be the national one, I always went up. Have you any connection with this?
Now, do you recall when you went down, for instance, when you were 14 to the suffrage headquarters, were there other young girls, or were you quite a new
I don't remember anybody my age. There were young people, but of course to me at 14 they seemed grown up. And I as I say, the good Lord, 14, it was 1902. I had a very vague memory. I don't even know where the office was anymore.
How did the women there treat you? Do you recall?
Oh, they were very nice to me. They made a kind of pet of me because I was so young.
So it was rather unusual then for somebody
I suppose
that young.
So. I would never have thought it was my mother that sent me down. She had no time to do anything, so I was her surrogate.
Now, you went to school then. You went to a girls' high school, you
yeah,
say?
Yes, we had. It's now called the Philadelphia High School for Girls, and is an entirely different part of the city. But we had, usually the principal of the school was a man. We never had any men teachers. All the teachers were women.
Oh.
And it was a very large high school. It was at that time the only high school for girls, and the other one, the Central High School, was only for boys.
Well, the high schools were segregated.
There were no co-educational high schools.
Was that true? Was that just true in Philadelphia, or was that generally?
Well, no, it was everywhere. I don't think anybody had ever heard of a co-educational high school when I entered high school in 1902.
That was 1902.
My father went to the. My grandmother told me that when she was high school age, she was born, I think, in 1833 or something like that. When she was high school age, the only way a girl could go to high school. They had classes on Saturday mornings for girls as a special favor. And I asked her what she learned. She learned some French and to play the piano after a fashion, things like dancing and etiquette and that sort of thing. And then when my mother went to high school, she went to the same high school I did. They had it every day then. But she had to drop out because her father died and she was the oldest girl. And, of course, the girl has to look after the little ones.
Now, was this run by the city, this school, or was this a private?
Oh, no, it was the public high school. I think the Quakers had a co-educational school in Germantown, but I don't know. I don't know anybody that went to it.
Now, excuse me. Was the curriculum different than the one in the boys' school?
In our high school, we were divided into three sections. One was what they called the general course, and most of those girls either finished their education in high school or they went on to what was then the normal school and became elementary school teachers. And then there was the classical course, which was also divided in two. That was college preparatory. You either took, you had 4 years of Latin, and you took either the two of Greek, French, or German. And then I see a little snobbery. We considered the Greek classes as a little above the French and German ones. But then my course was in the first one. It was the other college preparatory course. It was called Latin Scientific. And in those days, science was all German. So we studied, we had 4 years of Latin and 4 years of German. Hmm. And though my father was French, I never learned any French till I went to college.
So and that was in effect because they
that
were
was college preparatory for people who were more. And I wasn't particularly interested in science, and I don't know now how I got into that thing, but there was only one section of us all through the 4 years. Now I don't know how they have it arranged. It's probably very different.
Now, by that point, you decided, though, you weren't going to be a doctor.
No, but I also think what I wanted was lots and lots of English, and I got more English in scientific than I got in the classical.
I see. So it wasn't because you were still thinking about
taking... Oh, no, it wasn't because I was in science at all.
When did you reject the idea of going and taking over your parents' medical practice?
I don't think I so much rejected it as just ignored it and let it drop. And they didn't insist because they probably decided I wasn't going to be a very good doctor if I did. If you do a thing against your will, you're not likely to be very good at it.
Now, when did you say you were writing by the age of 12?
Well, that, of course, was rather facetious because I had a story published in somewhere in some paper. I can't remember what. I know I got a dollar for it. But actually, I started being published at about 18.
While you were still
when
in high school?
I was on the... well, after I got out of high school, you see, I had a scholarship at Wellesley, but that was just for tuition. And my parents couldn't pay for the difference, and so my father treated me to 6 weeks in a business college in my vacation after I graduated from high school, and then for a year I worked on the Philadelphia North American. I went back to it afterwards.
And what was that exactly?
Well, it was one of the biggest newspapers in the city then.
It was deceased.
It was owned by John Wanamaker's brother, Tom. And I was in the Sunday department.
Now, how did you happen to get that job?
Well, that's a long story. There was a department, there was a section called the Women's Section, 8 pages, on Sunday. And it had among other things, it had a department run by a then well-known novelist who called herself Marion Harlan. She was Albert Payson Terhune's mother, and her real name was Mary Virginia Terhune. And one of the things that she had on her page, besides answering questions and all, was a sort of club by correspondents. And I've forgotten, girls, you know, that correspond with each other on various things. And then somebody in Philadelphia, the paper was syndicated. I think we had 8 other papers, and all over the country. And somebody locally decided to make a real club of it and have meetings. So we did. And I belonged to it from the very beginning. And then this woman who was appointed editor of the section, for some reason, somehow, I suppose it's a matter of publicity, came to one of our meetings. And it was just when I was getting through business college, and she decided that I was just the person she was looking for. It was a combination of being the, typing all the letters and also writing, feature writing.
I see. What kind of article
did
they have?
Then I went back. I did nothing, of course, but feature writing.
What were the articles that they had?
What
kind of articles were these features?
Well, for a while I ran a health and beauty column. Also, I did some of Marion Harlan's work for her, answering letters. And one thing I'll never forget was a letter. Of course, I opened all the letters and some sent on to her that I couldn't answer and some I took care of. A good many of them were commonplace things we just sent and got her printed material. But I remember once a photograph came out of an envelope of a nurse in uniform, registered nurse, and a letter saying, "Will you please look at this picture before you read any more in my letter? And now after you have looked at it, will you please tell by looking at me whether you can tell I'm illegitimate?"
Was that printed?
No, it was not. I wrote her and told her that it was utterly impossible to see from anybody's appearance.
But in other words, a social question like that was not very usual in that.
Well, I don't know. I got plenty of others in that line. Some of them my superiors in office took away from me because they didn't think an 18-year-old girl ought to answer them. As I told this young man the other day, you young people think you invented sex. We did all the things that you do, we just didn't talk about them.
Well, now, what in this club that you were in?
Oh,
that
was just as though we just had meetings, and I don't know, we went to picnics in the summer.
It was just a social club.
It was a social club, yes. Had no
there was no
but it got me a job.
Or
and unfortunately, this my to-be editor had already engaged somebody whom she didn't like and was trying to get rid of. So she'd keep writing me all that summer. Well, I was working then on, I got a job with the people who published the theater programs, you know, the regular.
Was that connected with Edward Bach from the Ladies' Home Journal yet?
Mm-hmm.
Was that yet connected with Edward Bach, the editor of the Ladies' Home Journal?
No, I never knew Bach. I knew nothing about the Ladies' Home Journal any more than the Saturday Evening Post. But finally, she got rid of this woman on Thanksgiving Day. I remember we were at dinner, at the table on Thanksgiving dinner. She phoned me and said, "Come right down, you got the job." So I deserted the turkey and went straight down to the North American and started working. We didn't have holidays in those days and on newspapers.
Now, was your idea then to go into newspaper work, or it just was?
I hadn't thought of it until I met her, but it was a chance to write and be published, and that's all I was interested in.
So at that point, you were really quite
interested. And after I'd been there a few months, I wrote a long series of articles for a Baptist magazine, I forget its name, called "A Girl on a Big City Newspaper," using up my material as fast as I could, and from that time on, I wrote everywhere, especially poetry in those days. I think I must have had hundreds of poems published.
So it was primarily poetry?
Oh, yeah.
And were the feature articles ever related to the feminist issues, or they were?
No, of course not, never.
That never would have been published?
No, we just took it for granted that, well, as I remember, none of my editors on the North American were married, the women. But there was a woman photographer on the paper, which was very unusual in those days. She was divorced, Ernestine Allen, I still see her. And I did my freshman year at Wellesley, and then my scholarship gave out, and I had no more money, so I had to do something else. So what I did was come back home and live at home and enroll in Temple University, which was then very different from the enormous place it is now. And our classes were all in the evenings, and they were mostly teachers. And the College of Liberal Arts was very small, but I made up my mind that I would, in the summer I made arrangements that I went to the summer school at the University of Pennsylvania and then I credited back so that I graduated with my class.
Well, how long did you work on the paper before you went to Wellesley?
Well, from November to the next September.
And then you went to Wellesley?
And then
for
I went
year.
To Wellesley. But then when I came back, Ernestine Allen called on me a short time. And of course, I had to get a job right away. I can't remember. I've had so many different kinds of jobs. I can't remember. I think I was then a secretary to a doctor. An eye specialist. But anyway, yeah, she came to see me and asked me to come back. They'd sent her up, and I was too shy to, and timid to ask what my salary would be, but it was raised a little. I went back and I was with them then for 3 years.
And were you doing
But then I was not, then I was, we had a stenographer and I just was one of the, I was assistant editor.
For this women's section?
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, women journalists were rather frequent in those days, weren't they?
Well, there were very few women regular reporters. There were one or two, I think. Not on my paper. But this was all long before the days of the Newspaper Guild. And I remember Van Valkenburg, our editor-in-chief, used to say that he told one man he was in the process of firing that the North American turned out the best reporters in the United States, and the reporters said, yeah, they sure turn them out and walk. everything was on a very different slave basis. One man I knew got fired because he went up in the elevator with the editor-in-chief and didn't take his hat off.
Now, were the women on the newspaper staff paid less than the men?
Well, I wouldn't know, because you see, these things are relative. As my husband used to say, whatever happens, you get your hanging oats. And when we paid $35 for rent of a three-story house, for instance, when my first year in the North American, I got $10 a week. Second year, I got $15. Second time, but the Sunday editor, who was quite high up in the hierarchy, got $50. I know that a week. And my editor, Myra Smith, who also became my very good friend, got $23. But whether people doing the same work got the same pay, I wouldn't know. I don't think there were any women doing the same
thing. Generally, the women did very different work.
I don't think. Yeah, I don't think there were any women doing the same kind of work. They may have been on one or two New York papers, but they weren't on mine.
Now, what kind of study did you pursue when you were at Wellesley for that year?
What kind of
what plan of study did you pursue?
Well, I've always languages are the things that interest me. I took French and Greek and advanced English, two or three English courses, and I can't remember if I had I had more German later in Temple, but unfortunately at that time Wellesley made you take freshman math, and the part of the brain that thinks mathematically was left out of me. So 3 days before I was to graduate from Temple with high honors and a graduate scholarship at the University of Pennsylvania, I still had to pass off a freshman algebra condition. I'd taken the examination 3 times and failed. I'd never taken any math again, of course, and I'd completely forgotten a little I knew. So I was simply desperate. And we had the examination books you bought in the bookstore. So I got mine in advance, and I penciled very lightly little things like the binomial theorem. Somehow got through that examination. The mathematics professor who conducted it, I'd never had. His name was Napoleon Bonaparte Heller. I remember it very well. And he looked over my paper, and I said, did I pass? And he looked at me with a peculiar expression. He said, well, let's say so. So that's how I got to graduate school.
Well, now, when you were going to school, were you hoping to use your education to aid in your writing, or did you...
I don't think I ever thought about it. Everybody got educated. You had to go to school, and it was things a matter of course. Not many, even in the college preparatory courses, most of our girls from the classical course went to Bryn Mawr. In other words, going away to a college was rather... Still, some of my friends in high school, one of them went to Goucher. Two of them went to Bucknell, one to Cornell, two to Cornell. In other words, they did circulate around. And one girl, see, I was a year after my high school class in college because I'd had that year out. but one of my high school classmates was in Wellesley with me.
I see. What sort of experiences did you have at Wellesley in terms of the role that women were seen that they were going to play?
I think the way I was brought up, I just took it for granted that anything I wanted to do, I could do. And I don't think I ever thought about pay, because everybody's pay was so bad. I can remember when I lived in Boston, working in an office, I first went up there in the summer after I would see my class graduate in Wellesley after it was having to be later than mine. And I stayed up the rest of the summer and worked in various offices as a substitute for, when the girls were on vacation, I took their place. And I remember one place where the office manager called me aside and said, "Don't tell any of the other girls what you make, because you're a college graduate and you get more than anybody." And I was getting 7.5 a week.
So you were getting less there than on
no,
the newspaper?
No, I was getting 7.5. They were getting 7.
But you were making more than that on the newspaper, weren't you?
Oh, as I say, I got $10 at first and then 15. Mm-hmm. I never got above that.
Now, were most of the your professors at Wellesley women?
Most of them were then. There were men, but I never happened to have any. Mm-hmm. Now I think they're almost half of them are men.
And do you recall, were they primarily single women, or were
I think that in women's colleges, the women got just the same as the men. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure.
And were most of these unmarried women, the professors?
Most of them were, yes. I don't remember any of them were actually married. There was, in high school, my freshman algebra teacher was an old friend of our family who was a widow. But I don't think there were any women teaching who were still married.
If they were going to get married, they usually quit then.
Yeah, I suppose. Mm-hmm. When you got married, you left your job. Mm-hmm. And of course, a great many girls take that for granted now.
Now, did you have that attitude, or did you not even
think about it? Oh, no, I would never have given up my work for the sake of being married, hardly. I remember a few years ago, a girl I knew, in fact, one of my editors in a publishing house, wrote me that she was leaving because she was getting married. So I wrote back and said, "What about your fiancé? Is he leaving his job because he's getting married?" She never answered.
But most of the girls that you went to school with, for instance, at Wellesley, had that same attitude that...
Well, of course, we had such an enormous school. You can't say most of the girls that I went to school with my own
group.
The
girls that you knew.
Most of them didn't marry. Most of them became teachers. I had twin chums all through grammar and high school, twin sisters. And one of them became a teacher, an elementary school teacher, and then left to get married. And she had 4 children. But then times got hard and she went back to teaching while her husband was still alive. And that happened sometimes. But most of the girls I knew, if they got married, just didn't work anymore. Of course, some of them, the ones that didn't get married, didn't take jobs. They lived at home and took care of aged parents and that kind of thing. I hear occasionally from one of my classmates still, who never married, and